It's the afternoon cruise here on Jazz 88. I'm chatting with guitarist and composer Mary Halvorsen. Halvorsen is the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant for Music in 2019. She also recently released her album Cloudward on Nonesuch Records. We've been listening to the tune Collapsing Mouth. Mary Halvorsen, thank you so much for taking some time to chat with Jazz 88.
Of course, thanks so much for having me.
Now, I read in a recent interview that one of your focuses on this new record was in part to not overwrite, trying to leave some room for the things that happen with players that isn't on the page. And that makes a fair amount of sense to me, period, but especially the fact that everybody playing in your group is really talented improvisers. So I sort of wanted to ask the reverse question. What's the danger in potentially underwriting as somebody who has really done some thoroughly composed stuff and some stuff that leaves things open? Is there a danger with not bringing enough to the page to get started with a record?
You know, it's interesting to think about as somebody who's done many performances which are purely improvised. That's sort of one extreme. And, you know, I'm just thinking that the most extreme thing I could have done in the opposite direction would be to write nothing and just bring in a group of five of my favorite improvisers and see what happens. And that could be really cool, I think, in one respect, but that's also not my concept. I think for this group, I really like the idea of having compositions. So you have something to go on, which can then inform the improvisations and make the improvisation different than if there had been nothing on the page. So I guess for me, it's finding a balance between those two things, because you do have these great improvisers and you want them to be able to express themselves. So for me, the composition is functioning almost like a jumping off point to create a mood, to create a certain energy, to kind of set something up and then just see what happens. And I think the balance is finding that sweet point where you're not overwriting, so that you are letting go of control to some degree and just seeing what happens. And I do think my tendency is to overwrite. So I did try to step back a little bit with this music and really allow for both things to happen.
On the new record, Cloudward, what would you say was the biggest reward for not overwriting? What song do you think benefited the most from letting some things happen in the moment?
Well, I'll say the song that has probably the least amount of scripted writing would be Incarnadine. It basically has some basic cells, four basic cells that the musicians are kind of cycling through. But I gave everyone else's part also. So you have the option to play your own part, which is kind of like a suggestion, or you could play someone else's part, or you could not play it and just play in the general vibe of that particular cell. So that one, I think, was the one where I really had the least idea how it was going to sound. And I find that really exciting. You know, with a lot of, when you write like a very detailed composition, you kind of have a basic idea of what that's going to sound like. So with this one, I had less of an idea. And it was interesting because we've performed it live a bunch of times and it has kind of grown and developed in a certain direction. But at the same time, I think it's pretty different each time we play it.
I'm chatting with Mary Halvorsen. We're celebrating her release, Cloudward, on Nonesuch Records. And Mary Halvorsen, this album is really impressive in a lot of regards, and the way you have your players sounding cohesive and connected to what you've written, but also individual, reminded me of something. I had the joy when I was a freshman in college of hearing Matthew Shipp do a master class, and he said, at some point when you really get your thing together as an improviser, there's kind of a way you improvise and a way you encourage the people around you to improvise if you're the leader. I think he pointed out, like, if I'm with Roswell Rudd, I'm going to do a certain thing. If I'm with William Parker, I'm going to do a certain thing. And they might not be the same thing because they kind of bring me into their universe. As far as recorded output, you've definitely created a beautiful universe around you. What do you think players are doing differently when they work with you than when they might be on another gig?
That's a very good question. And I love Matthew Shipp, by the way. That's really cool. You got to go to his master class, and I like the sentiment he expressed there. I guess I will say it's hard to know sometimes how your own voice or the compositions you write is impacting other players. But I will say I notice as a side woman when I've played in other people's projects, you can tell when there's a composition which is inspiring you to improvise differently than you might not have otherwise. And you can also tell when somebody's music is strong enough that you are being brought into that world. So that is something that I'm aware of because I've had that experience as a side woman. Maybe it sounds like a cop-out answer, but really trying to create something with enough strength and enough identity that it gives you something to grab onto, but also not in a way that forces your hand.
Zero cop-outs detected right there, Mary Halverson. I'm with you on that. I want to talk a little bit about Patricia Brennan because I think if I had just gotten your album on iTunes, or not on iTunes, but just in my iTunes library with no information, and somebody said, "Who do you think the leader is?" I might have said the vibraphonist because some of the most beautiful moments and some of the most prime space are reserved for the vibraphonist. So I got two questions for you. What do you love about Patricia Brennan's playing? And then, can you tell me about your progression as a composer to make an album that, to a relatively discerning listener, you might still think is a vibraphone-led record? That means you're willing to put yourself in the background at some points as a guitar player. So, what do you love about her? And then, how did you mature to the point where you really aren't sort of leading just with the guitar sound?
Well, I think Patricia Brennan is a fantastic musician. And she's been a friend for a long time. We also teach a class together. I've collaborated with her in a couple different projects, but not in any projects of my own. But I've been wanting to work more closely with her for a while. And also, I love the instrument. I think it is a somewhat underutilized instrument in the vague umbrella world of jazz. So I really wanted to be doing something with her. And she really is just fantastic. So I had fun writing parts for her and all the other musicians in the band. You know, I think the comment you made about her, I could also see somebody thinking that it was one of the horn players as a leader. That's one thing I've also tried to do is this is not about me and my guitar playing. This is about a unit and a band. So I think I've always been fairly comfortable not having the guitar at the forefront. And in fact, I've had that as a criticism. People have said, "Why didn't you put more guitar solos in it?" And in my head, it's not about that. It really is about having all the musicians represented as equally as possible, and then also contributing to the group sound. Yeah, I think maybe your ears heard the vibraphone up front. Somebody else's ears might have heard something else. So I'm really thinking about it more three-dimensionally like that.
Sure.
But really myself as a composer, but then also as a member of the band, and less so as a guitar-led sextet.
I'm chatting with Mary Halverson. She recently released the record Cloudward on None Such Records. We've been playing the tune Collapsing Mouth. And one thing I read also about your last couple of years, Mary, is during the pandemic, you had a bunch of time on your hands to practice guitar without those sort of specific obligations of, oh, I got to get this under my fingers before something this weekend. But you were able to do it with a little less of an agenda. As somebody who's been, playing professionally for many, many years, when you actually sat down without that agenda, what had grown rusty and what hadn't? Like when you actually just got to hold the instrument in your hands, what did you discover about it?
I mean, I think that's a way I've always wanted to learn. I think as a musician, to not skim over things and to actually take the time to go into depth with different, whatever it is, learning scales or chords or sight reading or ear training, to really take the time. And especially if you feel you have something that could stand to improve, I think not rushing over things is great. And I think I've always been someone that worked well with no deadlines. And I know with some people it's the opposite, where you're going to write your paper the night before it's due and then you're super motivated to get it done. But I've always been the opposite, where that I sort of cave under that pressure. So if I have the time to be like, you know what, I'm going to work on C minor 9 voicings for 6 months, and not with the goal of having to perform it or record it or anything. So I think for me, having that time was really helpful. And it wasn't that I was noticing things I was rusty at. It was more I was noticing things I wanted to get better at, and then just taking the time to really just try to get better at the guitar, which is a really large thing. You know, I remember hearing Bill Frisell say once that it's like chipping away at a block of wood your whole life. So, you know, I think I'm always trying to get better and think about what I can improve upon. Again, that's how I work best when I don't have any pressing deadlines. So it's something I still try to do when I have chunks of time. It's just almost like go back to basics and just try to improve.
Well, college, Mary, is full of deadlines, and I have a weird question about your college experience. My brother, Steve McPherson, also attended Wesleyan, but a couple years before you. He graduated.
Oh, wow.
He graduated in 1998, and a little bit the same thing. He was going to study biology, and he ended up studying music. I think he took classes with Anthony Braxton, but he also Jay Hogard and a guy named Barlow. Like, he took a bunch of classes with.
Oh yeah, John Barlow and Jay Hogard. They're both fantastic.
So my brother, like, the transition with my family was pretty cool. People weren't like, "Oh my God, you got to study biology." Did you get hit? Was your family like, "We're paying a pretty penny for you to go to Wesleyan. We'd like for you to walk away with a biology degree," or did you have a relatively gentle transition for yourself and your family into pursuing music professionally?
I was very lucky in that I had parents who were very supportive of that decision. I found out later they kind of were freaking out, but they didn't tell me, which was very nice of them. You know, my father was a landscape architect. He's now basically retired, but he always wished he had pursued visual art. He's also a painter and a sculptor, but he chose landscape architecture, which is still a very creative field. But I think he had some regret that he didn't pursue being a painter or a sculptor. So I think in some way, the fact that I wanted to be an artist was a cool thing to him. I think my parents were freaked out by it, but you know, I guess they figured, well, she wants to give it a go, she should give it a go.
Gotcha.
And I was freaked out too. I mean, I also thought, wow, life in music seems impractical and a little bit terrifying.
And that was a correct assumption, right?
Yeah. You know, but I think at a certain point I felt, well, I feel this pull towards it and I feel like I have to do it. So I'm going to do it. So short answer, I was lucky. I had very supportive parents.
Good, good. And were you supportive of yourself? Did you go, okay, your soul is pulling you in this direction, let's follow it? Or did you try to pull yourself back towards more of a traditionally accepted career, like a biologist or a pre-med or something?
I think it was a difficult decision to make, and it took me a while to actually make the decision. But I think once I decided, I didn't look back, not once.
I've been chatting with Mary Halverson. We'll be wrapping things up. Mary, I got a final question, but thank you for making this record, Cloudward. We're loving playing it, and it's a record that I think a lot of folks might not think they would hear on jazz radio, but here at Jazz 88, we want to celebrate great stuff coming out of all sorts of sides of the jazz world, and it's a really beautiful thing to be playing your tune, Collapsing Mouth, and thank you for bringing great music into the world.
Oh, well, thank you so much, and thanks for playing it. And actually, if we're going to do a shout out to Minneapolis,
yeah.
John Dietrich, who is the producer on the record and who also mixed it, is a resident of Minneapolis.
Oh,
he's also the guitarist in the band Deerhoof. And so this record was actually mixed in Minneapolis.
Oh, that is awesome. Did you come up for the mixing or did John just do it?
I did.
Oh, cool. Did you like our city? Did you enjoy it?
I love it. Yeah, I had a really good time. I've been there a few times over the years.
I imagine.
But yeah, it's a wonderful place. So there is a connection between this record and Minneapolis.
That's awesome. Okay, here's a question for you. I read about people who won the lottery and there's things they hate about it. And I always go, oh, I don't know, that sounds pretty fantastic to have a jabillion dollars. And, you know, lotteries are generally way more than a MacArthur Genius Grant of $1 million. But was there anything annoying about winning the MacArthur Genius Grant, or was it purely in the positive side of the ledger? Was there anything where you're like, this is changing my life in a bad way, or this is putting undue demands on me, or was it just like, this is amazing?
I think I'm going to say it was pretty unilaterally amazing.
Yeah.
I feel very fortunate for the opportunity. I mean, it was stressful in a sense. You know, I think you do feel a sense of added responsibility and things like that, you know, wanting to do something good with that money, something creatively that has an impact. But no, overall, I'm so grateful for it. And, it's still hard to believe that actually happened. And, it's allowed me, especially the fact that it happened right before the pandemic when really all work stopped. It allowed me to not be worried about money during the
Right.
pandemic. I was worried about plenty of other things, but to have that weight lifted and to feel like I could actually be creative during that time is something that's probably what I'm the most thankful for.
Fair. And I should throw highlighter on this. I hope you already sense this, but I'm not like, oh, you won the lottery. You earned this through your hard work and recognition. I was just talking about a windfall financially. I'm not going
Yeah,
like,
no, I
yeah.
understand.
Mary Halverson, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with Jazz 88. And again, we sincerely appreciate you making this music. And I can't wait to find you in the Twin Cities for something more public than mixing the record. But you're making great music, and we're so glad that we can support it here at Jazz 88.
Well, thank you so much, and thanks for having me on the show.